You're listening to Amphibicast.
This week's episode of Amphibicast is sponsored by the Active Conservation Alliance. The Active Conservation Alliance is a 501c3 not-for-profit organization promoting ecosystem conservation and restoration, the sustainable use and the welfare for wildlife and human communities living in balance. With a special focus on dart frogs, many of the Alliance's efforts work towards the conservation and reintroduction of wild dendrobatids into their natural habitat. To get involved and to donate, please visit activeconservationalliance.org or follow the links in the show description. You can also text ACA to 61094. Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for joining me again. This week, I have a special guest. I have Michael Heinrichs of the Active Conservation Alliance. And if you recall a while back, we did a three-part series on Tesoros, but I really wanted to get a chance to talk to Michael himself. He has quite a long tenure in the hobby, and he's worked with many different species. So we're going to talk about his career in the hobby as a keeper and what's going on with the ACA as of now. If you've got a chance to catch that episode, it was on quite a few months ago. Maybe go back, give it a listen, and catch up on that. But we're going to kind of move full steam ahead, and we're going to talk about what's going on now with the ACA as well. But before we get into that, of course, I want to just cover the usual ground. I want to thank everybody for the nice five-star reviews, all the podcast players. That goes a long way. I always appreciate the kind words, the kind reviews. Great way to support the show. And if you're looking to support the show in another way, always consider becoming a patron on Patreon. I have some tiers that are as low as $1 a month if you want to just support the show that way. And I have the most popular tier, which is, of course, the $5 a month tier, which will get you a shout-out at the beginning of an upcoming episode. And as such, I do want to give a quick shout-out to our newest $5 patron. I want to give a shout-out to Alex Lynn. Alex, thank you so much for your patronage. I really appreciate it. Goes a long way. Helps me kind of defer a lot of the costs of the show. And it also shows that you value this type of content. I don't air commercials. I don't air ads. A lot of podcasts do that. I refuse to do that. It's not something I'm about. It's not something the show is about. So, Alex, I want to thank you so much for your support. You're definitely appreciated. And for everything else, if you want to support the show in different ways, of course, there's the merch store. You can find links to get t-shirts, socks, all sorts of fun stuff. I've got mugs. I've got the Amphibicast logo on pretty much anything you could possibly imagine. So check that out. And you'll also find a link to In Situ Ecosystems. If you'd like to buy a tank through In Situ Ecosystems and get a 10% listener discount, make a purchase through the link and you'll get 10% just because you're an awesome listener. So everything else, all that fun stuff out of the way. Michael, it's glad to have you back on the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Dan. Thanks for the invite. Really appreciate it. I love listening to your podcasts on a weekly basis. It makes the commute into the office, which is relatively short, so I get to listen to your podcast for a couple of days over the course of the week, and it's really enjoyable. So thanks for the invite.
I appreciate the kind words. Thank you. And you know, one day I really do, I have to go into a deep discussion about podcast listening habits, because I do get some I get some demographics, and I get some numbers, some statistics and whatnot, which have remained pretty consistent throughout the whole longevity of the show. We're going into the fourth year now, but I'm always curious about how long people listen and whatnot. So, you know, if any of you guys are interested in that kind of dynamic, I'd love to get some input, because I'm curious as to, you know, how long it takes someone to listen to a show. Like, I mean, like you mentioned, your commute is kind of short. So I know some people listen in 50-minute intervals. And some of the longer shows, like I'll listen to some longer shows and I can't make it through in one sitting. I have to break it up. So I don't know. Anybody with any thoughts on that, by all means, reach out, because I'm always curious about how the podcast pans out to the listener. But all right, enough. Sorry, I didn't mean to go off track. So
yeah, no, it's great.
Michael, we spoke last in the Tesoro series back around December. And we discussed a lot of the ACA and a lot of the conservation efforts that the ACA is going through. But we're going to talk about you, because you've had quite a long career in the hobby going back quite some time, and you've watched things kind of rise and fall. And I thought we would talk about that first and kind of walk through how you got into the hobby and what your focus became, and really just kind of maybe go back in time a little bit to some of the, you know, the beginnings of the hobby, and maybe talk about how some things have changed. But I mean, tell us about yourself. Like, how did you get into this? Like, walking back, what was your first experiences with amphibians or reptiles or whatnot? And how did you end up getting into this whole world?
Yeah, well, sure. Before I do, so I have to apologize to your listeners. I know I'm older, and so I have kind of that old voice. But last night, the wife and I, we live in Colorado, and one of the wonderful things about Colorado is the summer opportunities to go to an outdoor concert at Red Rocks Amphitheater. And last night, we went to the Noah Kahan concert at Red Rocks. And so not only is my voice going to sound older, but it's going to sound even worse because we had quite a time. But I'm loaded up with some Mountain Dew here. And, you know, took a quick nap this afternoon because I was pretty wiped last night. We got home late and it was a great time. So apologies to them. But, you know, to answer your question, as I look back, I just was so fortunate. I grew up in South Florida, so specifically Miami. And, you know, as such, you know, you're really in a unique place there as it relates to the United States. There's a number of different places across the country that are very special when it comes to reptiles and amphibians. And I think Florida in general is certainly one of those. And I remember it's really interesting because one of my first childhood memories is my dad was an orchid keeper. And we would go, you know, once a month, once every other month to some place where they, you know, there was I guess the Orchid Society would meet. And it was special for me because they always served Kentucky Fried Chicken, which we rarely had at our house. So at the potluck, it was awesome. But early on, I don't know how old I was. I was probably like maybe 5 or 6, I'm guessing, maybe earlier. And we were leaving, and there was this group that had clustered around, and a couple of older boys, I'd probably say in their teens, had captured a newborn Florida king snake. And I saw that, and I have to say that was the first time I'd seen a snake, and it was the first time I'd seen something that I thought was that special in regards to how beautiful it was. If you've ever seen a baby Florida king snake, they're just, you know, very, very unique and very beautiful in the sense that they had these blue hues and black hues and yellows and sometimes some orange splattered in. And it was just really cool. And they let me hold it. And I was like, wow, this really is a very, very neat thing to have. And so from that was the first time. And then, you know, that kind of got me started. And it kind of me started in a particular way in the sense that, you know, I really enjoy and I really liked things that were uniquely colored, I guess you could say. And maybe some of that has to do with the fact that my dad was an orchid keeper and we always had, you know, beautiful plants and beautiful flowers around. And so but being in South Florida, you really have a tremendous opportunity. And as a teenager, you know, well, even before a teenager in middle school, we would go snake hunting in the neighborhood. And I remember one place, it was a you know, kind of a native pond with cypress trees all around it. And an old crotchety man who was really, really upset with the fact that young kids would come on his property and hunt for ribbon snakes. But it was like one of the only places you could, and they were cool. And so we did that, and we caught corn snakes. And growing up, I remember, you know, many times we would go out to Davie, Florida and Flamingo Road and hunt the Australian pine trees and catch, you know, yellow rat snakes and red rat snakes. I mean, I remember the first Miami phase red rat snake that I caught. It was just, you know, this really cool red color and just the banded gray. It was just really neat. And just when you pop, when I pulled back the bark on the tree, which we no longer would want to do because you're destroying habitat. But at the time we didn't know. And, you know, fortunately Australian pines grow quickly. And so it returns to its native state relatively quickly. But As long as there's not too many people doing it, but it's like turning over a log or a rock somewhere, and you know, out pops this beautiful corn snake. And so those were the early days, a long, long time ago, when there weren't a whole lot of people that were out there doing it, and you know, hunting on Tamiami Trail and catching rattlesnakes and cottonmouths and all sorts of other, you know, name it, alligators, anything you could catch in the Everglades. We were catching big indigo snakes at times in different places, which of course we released because they were not legal to keep. I think they were Appendix 1 even at the time. They were protected. And so, but still, it was just a phenomenal time to grow up and get started in the hobby. And you know, just really had the opportunity then to, you know, visit all of these places that you read about in books, you know, basically going to these reptile outfitters, I guess you could call it, or salespeople, going to, you know, Chase Animal Farm. And, you know, I can't remember his name right now, but Van Nordstrom, the senior Van Nordstrom, the original store that he had put, not store, but it, basically they were importers, right? And, but the one that really struck me was a place called The Shed. And Louis Porras and Joe Baraducci were these two kind of, I call them fabled herp keepers, herp importers, herp distributors. And they really tried to do things right. And every chance I had, I'd ask my dad or I'd ask my mom or I'd ask my sister to drive me down there. We lived in North Miami. It was in South Miami, and it was a bit of a schlep. But every chance I got to finagle somebody to take me down there, we'd go. And, you know, those were amazing times because I can't imagine other places where you'd see, you know, this was really in the mid-70s. Where you'd see a fly river turtle or a side neck turtle or any manner of, you know, really unique. So it's the first place I saw a Lampropeltis alterna or a sulok or any of those kinds of really unique reptiles and amphibians. And you know, but that was, you know, one of the places where I really got caught in the hobby, because we were there on a visit and I walked in and I could see it literally from the front of the store all the way to the back. It wasn't a huge place, but it was reasonable enough. And there was this just amazingly cool looking green lizard in a tank. And I was hooked. That was it. So and that was Felsuma grandis. And so that took me down a rabbit hole that got me pretty deep in. So those are some of the earliest days and the earliest memories and really kind of what got me started. And fortunately, like a lot of folks on your show, I had some parents that were reasonably understanding. And while we couldn't keep anything in the house, I could keep it all outside and on the patio and had some protection. And you know, spent my money on snakes and keeping snakes and building cages and all the other things that you need to do to be successful there.
It was a remarkable time. I mean, I'm a little bit younger than you. I mean, we're both old, because most of my audience is in their 20s, but I remember the old days too, and it was interesting because I feel like I came around in that kind of transitional period where you had this, I guess maybe you call it like the classical era of the hobby, where things came into the hobby and it was just so different because by and large the majority of animals were wild caught. And it just, in retrospect, it just seems like such a different time. It was just such a different landscape when it came to the species that were available and the things that we kept. And I mean, the stuff that I had when I was 8, 9, 10 years old, 12 years old, whatever, I couldn't even imagine getting now. I mean, I had newts that I had no idea what their scientific names were. I don't even know if I'd even see them again in the trade. And a lot of that stuff has kind of gone by the wayside. But I mean, you made a focus though. I mean, like me going back then, my goal at the time was kind of to just try and keep a very eclectic bunch of things. I was kind of wanted to get experience with everything, but you focused on a genus of geckos, right? You focused on the Felsuma genus, right?
Yeah, I did. And, you know, at the time, you know, this is, now the late 70s, Madagascar was a communist country. And, if anybody knows their history, there was this thing called the Iron Curtain, and we did not do business with Madagascar. We did not do business with any communist country. And so they in turn didn't do business with us either. I mean, it worked both ways, right? And so there was no importing from Madagascar or any other communist country. Most of what we saw really mostly, I would say, came from, as opposed to now, I think there's a fair amount of import from Indonesia or from the Asian countries, I guess you could say. You know, at the time, it was mostly South and Central America, less South America, more Central America, I would say. And then there were, you know, and to your point from earlier, I mean, you would never see this today, but literally, you know, a space of, you know, 3 feet by 6 feet filled with various different, not very, that it was usually one species of lizard, but, or a tub, you know, a cattle trough tub that, you know, had one species of lizard, and there might've been 100 in them. You know, certainly not something that I think in any way was good or, you know, even I, at that point in time, I would look in there and I'd go, this just isn't right. That's why I was so fond of the shed, because what they did is they really focused on high quality and, you know, high interest animals. And so, and they took, you know, immaculate care of them. They were very, very, very good at what they did. And so, but yeah, to your point around Felsuma, you know, when I saw that grandis, I was like, you know, I have to have that. That said, it was $125 at the time. So, you know, I think now you could probably pick one up for, you know, $60, but the equivalent money of $125 at that time, basically would be equivalent to $500 today. So imagine, you know, Felsuma grandis costing $500. Nobody in their right mind would pay for that today. But at that point in time, they were that rare and that hard to get. And I was fortunate because my family is German. And so we had family back in Germany, and I had I spoke the language, wrote the language, read the language, and we pretty much, you know, every 2-3 years, we got the opportunity to go visit in our summer holidays, and we'd go back to Germany, and so I had family there, and I had heard, at least through the grapevine somehow, that Felsuma were, you know, that people kept Felsuma in Europe. And so really interesting story. So I was in my teens, and I got to travel alone to Germany. And I packed up a bag of various different reptiles that I had collected and bought here in the States. And off I went to Germany with the expectation that I was going to be able to get some Felsuma. And I don't even recall how it happened, and I don't know who led me specifically to him. But in that trip, I believe it was through a friend of a friend of a friend of the family, was introduced to Gerhard Hallmann. And Gerhard Hallmann basically was, in my opinion, probably the most prolific keeper of Felsuma at the time. And certainly had a, you know, fantastic collection there in Germany. And I went to go visit his place. And it was the first time that I'd ever seen a Euro-style vivarium. in the United States at the time, everything was kept somehow either in a wood box, right? So, you know, like a snake cage was basically a wood box with glass fronts that slid back and forth, or in a tank with a cover, you know, either a screen cover or a glass cover, something along those lines, or both. And so, you know, the idea of this Euro-style vivarium was just fascinating. And I learned how to make a Euro-style vivarium when I was at Gerhardt's. And, well, actually, I called him Herr Hallman, so Mr. Hallman. And so, you know, basically, I just got to see his collection. So yeah, he had them all, I think, pretty much, some rare exceptions. But the ones that I never got were the ones that came from that Gerhardt didn't have. But he had Pilsumer grandis and Madagascariensis and just, you know, the whole Sundbergi, the whole rack. And then all of the small species, you know, Gimboi, when I saw that one, I just about lost my mind, I think. When you see a male in full color, it's amazing. Cypediana, the same thing. And, you know, Klemmer, I hadn't even been discovered. So the one species of Felsumba that we have so many of in the hobby right now, you know, hadn't even been discovered at that point. And while Lygodactylus Williams, I had been discovered, you know, nobody anywhere had them, and they weren't even talked about. I don't even know if people understood at the time that it was an electric blue lizard. And so, because they certainly would have gone to find it. So in any case, that was the first time I really had the opportunity to get involved and focus the collection. And that it's exactly what I did. Everything kind of went towards figuring out how to get more Felsuma. And we ended up, I ended up with a collection of, it was about 20 different species. I was either the first or second breeder of almost every one of those species that I mentioned, and then many more outside of that. And, it was a very interesting time, because that Euro style vivarium just didn't exist in the US hobby. So pretty sure I was one of the first, if not the first, to actually build it. And the way I did that was I would very carefully take the side, or you know, the short side of the 10-gallon vivarium, or a 20-gallon vivarium, or a 35-gallon vivarium, and I would very carefully cut out the silicone, and then I would put a screen top on it, and put a single pane of glass on the front, which I would use like a door hinge kind of a thing, and a mount that you have in a kitchen cabinet that is a magnetic mount. And then I would, you know, basically put everything together with the ventilation and the whole nine yards. It was very, very cool to do. I remember, one of the people that had gained a fair amount of notoriety in the hobby, with Felsuma, a guy named Tim Title, came to my house, and this was a long time ago, and he basically was enamored with that Euro style tank. And so, you know, that's where I got started. Lots of great stories there. One in particular that kind of stands out and kind of does speak to kind of that day and age. Importing was unique. We had to time everything properly. It's not like you got everything, you know, sent over in, you know, through air transport. A lot of things actually were sent in the mail, the U.S. Postal Service, so to speak. And I remember one day walking out to the mailbox, and I had not been notified. I didn't know it was coming. And I opened the box, and there's a package from Europe. And it looked like animals, and I take it back in, and there's a letter from Gerhardt Hallman that basically said, "Hey, here's a new species of Felsuma. Thought you would like," and it was the first time that Robert Merton's eye, Phil Silmer, Robert Merton's eye had been introduced in the United States, and they were in weak shape, I have to say. But I nursed them back to health and got the first pairing out of them. And that presented a lot of challenges because those small species at the time, we didn't breed fruit flies. We didn't have springtails. And that's another place where I was fortunate to have been in Florida. I was at the University of Florida at the time. I was able to get access to termites. And termites were the gift. Really, the big gift was basically that they ate a lot of fruit. And, you know, we didn't have Pangaea back then, right? You know, we didn't have access to all of these foodstuffs that we now use. I basically utilized my background. I had, at the time I was in pharmacy school, and I used my background to concoct all the various different things that we needed in order to be able to care for these animals here, because in Europe they had been a little bit more advanced, but you couldn't get the stuff. I got my calcium powder, probably most of it from Europe, but everything else was bought, you know, somehow figured out here. So I would buy baby food, and I would mix pediatric vitamins into the baby food as my supplement. We didn't have UV. So, we just had to really jam pack the calcium and the vitamins and hope for the best. And it turned out really great. So everything reproduced. It was very successful. But it was a different time.
Oh, absolutely. I feel like that's one of those things that's lost on a lot of younger keepers. And I have listeners who've just started in the hobby within the past 2, 3, 4 years. And I try to explain that things weren't always, I mean, obviously people understand that they get that this is a progression, but the old days, I guess we'd call them, it was such a different landscape. We didn't have the variety of feeders that we have. We didn't have, I mean, I remember the lighting. I remember using a Vitalite, which was the recommended lighting to supply. I mean, I don't even know how effective it was, but that was when I got an iguana when I was about 10 years old. You had to have your Vitalite. And it's amazing how the technology has progressed since then and how much easier it is and how much more forgiving it is for people to work with a species that's captive bred and has been in the hobby since 70s, 80s in some cases. Like the dart frogs that we have now, not all of them, but like, say, for example, like Azurius or Aratus, things that have been in the hobby for the past 30 years, are just so more forgiving than the animals that were, like, you know, under development back then. I'm curious about the Euro slider, though. I mean, what year was this, just for some kind of context, that you started building your own Euro slider type tanks?
It was the late 70s.
Okay. It was a while back. Why do you think it took such a long time for them to catch on?
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact you had to build your own. I really admire Troy Goldberg and all of the others that, you know, build their own vivariums. It's a lot of work, and there's trial and error, and you break things and things don't work out and leak. And so there was a lot of challenges there. And so when I built the first ones, fortunately, I was working with Phil Silmer, so I didn't have accumulating water at the bottom, but there were certainly times where water would accumulate. And so there was always the risk that the darn thing was going to leak because you didn't silicone it proper. I think now probably we do a better job with that. But, you know, you just like I said, you know, I had to meticulously take the short side out of the aquarium. And if you bought a 35-gallon aquarium and, you know, it cost whatever it cost at the time, arguably probably it costs similar dollars today to what it cost then, just because things were less expensive as it relates to materials and the like. But, you know, maybe not. It's maybe with factories and everything now, it's more or less, I guess you could say. But in any case, you just the work that went into building them, it was not easy. And there was always risk associated with it. And so and you know, just the lack of familiarity, I think was a large part of that as well. So, it was a lot of fun because you did build your own and you did do something that was very different, and very unique. But you know, I think you know now I feel very fortunate that we have the type of access to things like the in situ ecosystems and other, you know, Exoterra and the things that just make speed to money getting into the hobby a lot easier and a lot faster and a lot more efficient as far as being able to keep things. So that would be my guess.
Yeah, it really does. It really is interesting how much the enclosure landscape has changed, you know, since the old days. And I remember thinking to myself when I was a kid in the 80s, just how dissatisfied I was with the types of enclosures that were available. I mean, realistically, all you had were 10, 20, 30, and 40-gallon tanks. And if you had something really large, you had that, you know, that big 55-gallon aquarium, which in retrospect just seems like it was just totally inappropriate. And the amphibian stuff really wasn't much better. I mean, you basically kept amphibians almost exactly the same as reptiles, unless they were aquatic or semi-aquatic. But at some point, you transitioned into keeping amphibians. Like, what was the amphibian hobby like in the 70s and 80s?
It was hard, I got to say. So, you know, at the same time that I was keeping the Felsuma, I had had opportunity to go down to the shed and I, you know, go down there and I saw my first redhead, Faga histrionica there. I saw my first Lamani there and Ranitomaya, although at the time everything was called Dendrobates, right? And so, just all these, you know, amazingly beautiful frogs. And at the same time, some of the most unique salamanders you were referring to before, like, you know, Pyramus triton and others that, you know, you just would not see, you know, Vietnamese Vietnamese salamanders, I think, because they probably came in through some Hong Kong and were, you know, effectively smuggled into Hong Kong and then imported in the United States. But you get these, and I did. I bought my first redheaded Faga histrionica for, I think it was $25. I bought my first Faga Lamani for $35, which, you know, in today's dollars is four times that. But, you know, it's still, comparatively small money compared to what we're talking about today, right? And Ranitomaya, and what I really loved was Mantella. So Mantella from Madagascar, right? And so, the golden Mantella was, you know, really one of those things that I wanted to keep and have on the list. I was able to get those from Europe, and I added those to the collection. But it was incredibly hard because we had no idea how to keep them. And the ones I was able to keep the longest were the gold Mantella. And I was able to keep them alive for a year and a half, 2 years, something like that. But, you know, the idea of being able to reproduce them, just, you know, that didn't have, they're hard enough as it is to reproduce, but back then you could barely keep them alive. And one of the big things was that we didn't have those feeders that we have today. So no springtails, no fruit flies. I mean, you had fruit flies, but nobody had figured out that, you know, you could use some things that didn't stink up the entire house by just having one culture. You know, at the time, you know, fruit fly culturing was, it was just disgusting. And so nobody would want to keep fruit flies. And so there were no fish. So we used pinhead crickets. And pinhead crickets, when they're not eaten, grow to small crickets, grow to mid-sized crickets, and then they start eating on the animals that are, you know, for whatever reason, weak. And then you end up with, you know, injured animals, and they succumb quickly. I think the two things that I was able to keep the longest were Bolitoglossa splendida and Manatella arantiaca. And those were the big longest kept ones. I was really dutiful about it, but it was literally impossible. The only place where it really worked was I had the opportunity to work in Marty Crump's lab at the University of Florida, and we had a big setup. It was probably, I'm going to say, 4 feet by 4 feet. And the saving grace there was termites. We had a Faga Pumilio that she was working on the parental care aspect of Faga Pumilio. And fortunately, the lab was humid enough that, you know, you didn't have this issue of humidity that you see that, you know, at the times we would put them in a 10-gallon aquarium with a glass top, it would get too humid. And we put them on sphagnum moss. It was, you know, inevitable that they were going to get some sort of a infection and die from that. The idea of going vertical with them just didn't exist. And so, you know, we just didn't understand their natural, the way they operate in nature, and the fact that they use vertical spaces, you know, abundantly. And so we put them on the same kind of frame, I think, in our heads as we would with other things. You know, tree frogs, we would plant the vivarium, but we'd still keep them in the same setup. I had Phyllomedusa, you know, various different Phyllomedusa. I had red-eyed tree frogs, you know, I had a Telopus varius, right? So a Telopus varius is, you know, probably a storied animal for most people at this point. But I would go down and buy another, you know, two or three every time, you know, a couple died, just hoping that they would, you know, survive and I'd figure it out. And the idea of husbandry at the time really didn't much exist. So when you think about it and when you read about it, the zoos often, husbandry didn't matter necessarily to the zoos. The zoos basically just bought an animal, and when it died, they'd replace it. And I learned the construct of husbandry from the Germans. But it was just interesting because when you look at it, I'd also had opportunity to collect wild field collect salamander, so the fire salamander, and various different Trituras in Europe, and brought those back. And that didn't work because, you know, I was in Florida, it was too hot, right? And so, you know, when you look back at it, it was just this constant trial and error. And we're just very fortunate today that we have the foodstuffs and the supplements, because I just used the calcium powders that I had gotten from, you know, Europe for my Felsuma for the frogs. And, you know, we didn't have the vitamins, and we didn't understand carotenoids at the time or any of that stuff. So it was just tough keeping amphibians alive for any length of time. Really unfortunate, but it was a good learning experience. And, you know, just really so happy now that we've gotten to a place where it's gotten that much better. So.
So if you had Ophaga lamani in the late 70s, early 80s, what went to the tank? How would you set your tank up? Because obviously things have progressed dramatically from then to now. What went into the tank? Like, what supplies did you buy, and how did you source materials? Like, what, walk us through a 1970s, 1980s Ophaga lamani tank.
So Ophaga lamani, I would get, what are those, green plants that I can't remember their name. They're not the ones that grow like crazy that are commercially available. I can't remember what they are, but they're like a vining tropical plant that's commonly used in house plants. And they were pretty common back then, and especially in Florida. And we would put a pot of that in there. In a like a 10-gallon aquarium, we'd put a pot of that, and we'd put some sphagnum moss on the bottom, which we would change on a, you know, reasonably regular basis. But, you know, you didn't want to change it, you know, every, what you really probably need to do is, you know, change it on a, you know, every other day basis, you know. But we were changing it on a monthly basis, and have that, you know, that a couple of different types of plants that tolerated humidity and operated well in reasonably low light. And that was pretty much it. The construct of a bromeliad didn't really come to mind, and the construct of having, you know, a continual water source. So we would just hand mist, and then, you know, throw pinhead crickets in, and you know, they would take the crickets without a problem. And it's just that the crickets became a problem, and we just didn't recognize it until it was too late.
Yeah, crickets are a disaster. Even the crickets that we used to have, the domestic cricket, have kind of been replaced by the banded cricket too. So that's another thing that might be lost to the annals of history. Is we're using a completely different species of cricket now, which is a lot more forgiving and kind of stinks less too. Now, progressing forward, As the hobby progressed from the 70s into the 80s into the 90s, like, how long did you stay in the hobby, and how, like, what did you notice as it progressed through the next couple of decades?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing that I would add, you know, that I think is interesting is, you know, back then, the idea of, you know, this was the time, you know, so I was an acquaintance of Tom Crutchfield and a lot of other, Eugene Bissett and others that were, you know, pretty prominent, I would say, in the hobby then. And the focus wasn't, you know, the idea of anybody caring about falsium. I went to one of the first, you know, I know that Tom Crutchfield and other episodes of other podcasts has talked to the first herp gathering, if you want to call it, the herp collectors gathering in the United States in Monroe, Louisiana, of all places. Why Monroe, Louisiana, I still ask to this day, but I'm sure somebody knows. I think it had something to do with a zoo that was close or something. I don't know, but Monroe, Louisiana was a long ways away. I actually took the bus, and I took some Falsuma grandis with me, thinking that everybody was going to be like, wow, that's really cool. And I get there, and everybody, and the only topic of conversations really amongst herp keepers at that time, and for many years thereafter, I think, was big snakes and other big reptiles and things of that nature. So, you know, the boas and the pythons and the, you know, Burmese pythons and reticulated pythons and, you know, iguanas, various different types of iguanas. And of course the tortoises, the various different tortoises. So, you know, those, it was a very different time in the sense that nobody really cared about a small frog. Nobody really cared about a small lizard or, you know, any of those kind of, I'll call them more eclectic type of reptiles or amphibians. And so, if you were a collector of anything aside from a Burmese python or a reticulated python or a boa or something along those lines, you were really a pure, unadulterated hobbyist. This was 100% a hobby. And, you know, I recognize at the time there was no internet, there was no cell phone, there were, you know, whenever you made a long distance phone call, it cost money. So we wrote a lot of letters, you know, and so we got lists of amphibians and reptiles that people got. And so, you know, a very different type of time then. And you know, you could just see over time progression as, you know, some of the more unique things came into the hobby. You know, there was a big flood of Falsuma that came into the country. I left, my collection behind. I left the hobby in the late, it was about 1990. And, you know, but I followed the hobby the whole time. And you know, there was a huge influx of Falsuma. They were even in pet stores. And today, unfortunately, so many of those species that were imported at the time, you know, are no longer available because there just wasn't, you know, a lot of people that wanted to, you know, keep Falsuma or frogs in glass cages, I guess you could say, or anything else that was more on the eclectic side. And so the hobby, you know, basically became, you know, the corn snakes and the morphs that came out of corn snakes, the morphs that came out of California king snakes, And then, you know, of course, the ball python rage grew up, and boas at the same time, along with, you know, Burmese pythons until they invaded the Everglades, I think, probably. But, you know, those were all, you know, kind of, that was the big focus. And it wasn't. I left the hobby really, you know, kind of like, you know, in an attached way. In 1990, I would go to herp shows on a regular basis and see kind of what was happening. And I wouldn't say it really changed. I think in the 2000s that the constructs of how to and how to properly care for amphibians started really coming into form. I mean, back in the early 90s, I remember that, I think it was maybe Trooper Walsh at the Washington Zoo, I'm not sure where it was, or maybe it was the Baltimore Aquarium, where they had, you know, started the construct of rain chambers and successfully bred red-eyed tree frogs and the like. You know, that was, it took a long time before the hobby really adopted bivarium species.
And when did you get back into the hobby? What prompted you to, because we've all done it. I mean, I walked away, but I stopped becoming such an avid keeper for a while, and I got back into it again. What drew you back into it?
Well, you know, I always wanted to keep and work with dart frogs. And so, but I had a busy, you know, career, and, you know, things were, you know, very, you know, family and all those things that kind of, you know, you focus on as you go. But I always really enjoyed going to herp shows and seeing what was happening, and, you know, maybe connecting up with an old friend or colleague. And I, I'd literally go on professional meetings. So I was very involved with a number of different pharmacy societies, and I would go to those meetings, and I'd always like plan a herp trip. I remember one day that I went to the desk, and, you know, basically was getting instructions from the person on what I had been told was an area that had, it was in Arizona, had reptiles that I might be able to find on the road, like rattlesnakes and sidewinders and the like. And one of my colleagues was standing there, and they're going, "Where are you going? What are you doing? You're going where?" And so, I always stayed attached, but the thing that got me was I was just trolling on YouTube, you know, basically, you know, same thing, kind of, you know, curious about what was happening in the hobby and what was, you know, what was exciting and new. And I happened to come across some videos on dart frogs. And I think one specifically where Troy was talking about building a Euro-style vivarium. And all of a sudden I was like, okay. And so how did they get past the feeder problem? And how did they get past the, you know, fact that you don't, you know, because I didn't want to change paper towels every day. I didn't want to change sphagnum moss every week. How did they get past that? And so I learned about the various different things that we have in the hobby now that we didn't then. And it became clear that I could keep dart frogs in captivity and not kill them. that was always disheartening to me and very, very frustrating. And so learning that, you know, there were people that had kept dart frogs for 10 years plus, you know, when I was connected to Germany, I was connected on the Felsuma side. I was never connected on the dart frog side. And I think had I been connected on the dart frog side, I probably would have had a longer longevity in the hobby, simply because, you know, that was one of those things that I just really loved. And so that's when I started back in. And I went to a local herp show, and there was a vendor that had some dart frogs. And, you know, I just basically bought everything at that time brought it all home, figured it out, put it together based off of all the information that I could find online. And that's basically how I got started. And that was basically the year before COVID.
And moving forward now, have you increased your collection in size? Like, I mean, obviously, besides the first couple of species that you got, what do you have currently?
Yeah, no, I definitely have. My wife has been very forgiving in the sense that I think I've doubled the number of vivariums that I told her I would have. I have a dedicated room in the house, fortunate in that regard, and have about, I think it's about 20 pairs of various different Ufaga. So I focus 100% on obligates. I don't have anything that I have to raise a tadpole. I raised my first tadpole a few months ago for a specific reason. But aside from that, I let the animals do the work. I don't want to have to raise tadpoles. And so that's the beauty of Ufaga, is that, you know, basically you put the pair together. They lay some eggs, the male fertilizes the eggs, the female transports them to the bromeliad, the female cares for them for months, and then one day you just get this, you know, super cool looking froglet appearing on the bromeliad leaf, and, you know, you're just enamored. And so I have a number of large form Ufaga. So I just got my first Pakasi froglets. I'm really excited about that. They're just as, every bit as cool as you'd think they'd be. And I have a number of Pimelio species, but my real love and focus is Ufaga vicentii.
You know, I want to get into vicentii, but one thing you said earlier that kind of stuck with me, and you mentioned how in the 80s and whatnot, and moving into the early 90s as well, how the bulk of the hobby, the exotics hobby, was generally reptiles, and amphibians were kind of a footnote, but big constrictors, ball pythons, and then kind of getting into the morphs, and you said everything else was kind of just a hobby. And what I've noticed is within the past maybe 5 years or so is that a similar thing seems to be happening with dart frogs, whereas Aratus and Azurius are kind of the bread and butter species that anybody has, beginners, whatnot. They breed arguably much easier than a lot of the obligates. And it seems to me, though, that now the obligates have kind of become their own hobby within the greater hobby. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Because you seem to be drawn to certain kind of very niche species. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that about I don't mean like disconnect, like negative or positive, but I mean maybe some kind of a disconnect between the people who are really into obligates versus the greater dart frog community?
Yeah, you know, I see a lot of mixed collections, and you know, I think they're all beautiful. And so I loved Aratus. The only ones for whatever reason, and, you know, call me weird, I'm not a fan of Tinks, and I'm not a fan of Terribilis, right? And so, you know, those big frogs that I think a lot of people are, and absolutely for great reason, because they're just very engaging frogs, and they're bold and just, you know, badass looking frogs, I guess you could say. It's just not, you know, my thing. But, you know, I know a lot of people that have mixed collections. And I think if it weren't for the fact that I like a challenge, and so, obligates present a little bit more of a challenge, or a little bit more challenging, I think, in times to keep and to breed. And so, that's one thing. And then the other thing is, like I said, you know, I just don't want to raise tadpoles. And so that's, you know, that is that's just a great piece of opportunity that you have with obligates, is that there's no need to have, you know, the water mess or the exchanges or any of that work that goes along with, keeping you know, Tinks or Aratus or Terribilis or Ranitamea. And, you know, not that I, frankly, if I had unlimited space, I probably would, and time and energy and the proclivity to do that, I probably would have Ranitamea too, honestly, because they are just such amazingly beautiful frogs. You know, for me, I think the focus and is, you know, a little bit more challenge, still get the full spectrum and beyond of the colors, and at the same time, a little bit less work. But you also get a lot less frogs, right?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But that's what I mean about the – you can't really – how do I put this? You can't have a high turnover with – obligates and make a consistent business out of it. I mean, from a business point of view, you're better off selling Azurius and Aratus and any other of the Tinctorius locales or whatnot, just because they're much easier to reproduce and to churn out. It can be affordable. Whereas the Ophaga is, I mean, kind of like what you mentioned, I think you said your father was an orchid grower. It takes so much more cultivation to be able to get an end product that you kind of really do it more for the process in and of itself than the outcome, I guess. I don't know. Maybe that's just me being a little too philosophical. No,
I think you're absolutely right. You know, because one of the big things is price point, right? I mean, when you get, you know, six frogs a year out of a pair, or, you know, if you're good, you might get 9 or 10. But when you get that few out, as opposed to what you might get, you know, in, you know, you know, one clutch of eggs with an Aratus, well, in one clutch of eggs, you might get a lot more. I don't know. But the fact is that you just, your production is much lower. So the cost is much higher. And so, you know, and you see that because you see the progression, the cost of Aratus versus the cost of Tinks versus the cost of Terribilis, and, you know, goes up with Ranitamea depending on which morph it is and or your species. And then, you know, you get into the obligates and that, you know, that does present a challenge as it relates to entry and as it relates to, you know, just kind of keeping them, can you sell them, that type of a thing. And so for me, you know, again, it's just a pure hobby. Just, you know, there's not a business aspect for it for me. And so that's one of the things that I'm fortunate in regard. And I just really enjoy them.
That's one of the things that kind of intrigues me about people who work with obligates. And it's, I feel like anyone who works with obligates has a really, really significant dedication to the hobby, because you're right, it's not something you're going to have a high turnover with. I mean, in the reptile hobby, it seems like people want to get into this game where, oh, I'm going to breed this new ball python morph and I'm going to make all this money and I'm going to reinvent the wheel. Whereas with obligate keepers, it's this whole other experience. Like, it's kind of this knowledge that it's like, what do they call that? A hobby is, I'm going to try and phrase this as best I can, but like a hobby is a job that you don't get paid for. In fact, it's a job that you lose money on. And I feel like large obligate keepers seem to be the people who are like, have the biggest appetite for this thing that rewards you in any way that's completely not financial. So it takes a special type of person.
100%. And, you know, that's kind of the Vicentii story, right? And so when you know, my favorite, you know, Vicentii, now I don't have them all and all that. So, you know, I mean, there's plenty others out there that, you know, hopefully one day we'll have in the hobby in larger number or in numbers at all. But it is the blue-green Vicentii. And I have five pairs, right? Which is stupid, you know, because, you know, it's not a high demand. You know, I have red Vicentii too. And the reason why I landed there is because the first time I saw a picture of a blue Vicentii, I just about lost my mind, right? And I was like, gotta have that. I don't know if that'll ever be possible, only to find out that they were in the hobby. And then I saw a picture of a red one. And I was like, well, that's never going to happen. And, you know, they were available. And so I, you know, basically, but the blue green Vicente, why do I have that many? Well, you know, if you plan on one pair, you know, you may not get where you want to get, and they're so variable that it's nice to have, you know, I'm working on trying to figure out, you know, to be able to predict better which ones are going to turn out with a higher blue component, which ones are going to, you know, have, you know, lend themselves to, you know, more than likely the coloration in blue-green Vicente is multi-allelic as it relates to the contribution to the color and to the pattern. And so, you know, it's not one of those things that you can just line breed and get, you know, 100%, you know, just, you know, solid blue frogs or whatever. And they're so variable. You know, and when I say variable, I've literally watched them change color, you know, go from, you know, that when they're courting and they have this, you know, beautiful blue coat on, and they, you know, just like a chameleon or a, you know, Anolis carolinensis. So the, you know, or the, many of the different Anolis species that, are, you know, bright and colorful. And so when they're courting, they do the same thing. And, you know, you have this beautiful blue coat, and then they basically, you open the door on the vivarium to take the picture. And, you know, for whatever reason, at that particular point, they, you know, are all of a sudden, oh, I want to be shy. And they kind of crouch down, and their color will basically become like much more green, and even to olive, depending on which frog it is. And so, but to your point, you know, if you have one pair, you know, and you lose one, then you're out looking for another one. And it's happened to me with various different, you know, I had a red saddle last year. I lost the male, and you know, very unfortunate. And so, you know, it's been a year, I think almost a year since I was able to replace it. And so, yeah, that happens that way. And so, you know, for me, it's been a matter of kind of having some backups or having things that I can back it up with. So, but I just love the Vicente. The blue greens, especially the reds are spectacular. I don't care what anybody says. Probably one of the most spectacular frog in the hobby. You know, they just have that strong red coat and those, that really interesting modeling on them, and just a beautiful, beautiful frog. And a lot of people say that Vicente are shy. I have ones that are just, I call them stupid bold. You know, they just sit there and look at me and like, hey, you know, what's up? You know, you gonna feed me or what? You know, or you just here to look and take pictures.
How many locales are there?
Oh, there's a number, you know, and I don't, you know, they find new ones. Recently they found some new ones, and, you know, there's so much controversy as it relates to, you know, the various different color morphs and locales, but there's certainly at least, you know, there's multiple known localities of just the blue-green Vicentei. There are supposedly, I don't know, I've heard two different localities of reds. I'm not sure that that's 100% true, but, and then there's, you know, other type, there's yellow, and then there's various different green levels. And so there's several different color morphs of and localities of Vicentei.
Is there anything other than color that endears them so much? I mean, when you and I discussed off air what we're going to talk about, it was you really wanted to discuss this species. Like, what about them sets them apart from, say, like Lamani or Histrionica or some of the other species that are just so highly coveted? Like, why, what about them specifically, like, besides the color?
Behaviorally, I just think they're the most, so, you know, I have a background, my degree's in zoology. I was planning to become a researcher until I basically took my animal behavior class with this professor who absolutely hated men. I actually, interestingly enough, I took the class with the person that ultimately became the curator at the Miami Zoo. And, you know, of the seven males that were in the class, I was the only one that survived the class. Everybody else dropped out. And you know, I went to my advisor and I was like, hey, you know, what's the deal? And he's like, yeah, everybody knows it, but she's got tenure. So, you know, you're either going to have to gut it up or drop. And so, you know, but that animal behavior class, you know, taught me a lot. And I really love watching the Vicentii because they're an arboreal species. And so when you, so, you know, the Histrionica are walkers. I call them walkers, right? Because they when they come down to the floor, they're really walking, I guess. And you know, kind of they walk to where they're hunting their prey. And then they basically mosey on up to the wherever they're going to go. And you know, on rare occasion do you see them kind of like hop from one leaf to another, but it's a really concerted effort when they do. You just see them focusing. They're 100% in. And Pamilio are in between the Histrionica and Vicentii. And what I love about Vins is that they are just acrobatic, in my opinion. And because they are as bold as they are in many cases, you know, every once in a while there's one that's a little shyer than the rest, but you'll still see them on a regular basis. But because they are so adept at being able to climb, they just move through the vivarium at you know, with grace and ease. And they, if they, I've seen literally one, I've seen, you know, situations where the frog sees the fly on the other side of the vivarium, and literally in you know, a millisecond, he's like boom across the vivarium and has the fly eaten. And just, I don't see that with the other Ufaga. I don't keep Rhanotomia, and I don't know. I would imagine they're similar in that respect. It's just that arboreal nature and their behavior patterns, and their boldness and beauty. I think all of those combined. And one other thing that I think is really, really valuable, and that's, I believe that they can be kept in smaller vivariums. And so, you know, great controversy. People are like, you know, hey, you know, it's cruel and unusual to keep anything in anything less than a, you know, 24 by 18 by 24. I've done the math, and you know, if you actually took an Ufaga histrionica and you basically measured it out in square centimeters, and then measured out the vivarium in square centimeters, you can fit about 10,000 of those buggers in a you know, usable space, 24 by 18 by 24. You can fit the same or more Vicentii in a 12 by 12 by 18. And so, you know, when you consider, you know, the complete living space based on the size of the animal, you know, they lend themselves very nicely to small vivariums. And so I keep breeding pairs in 12 by 12 by 18s, or 12 by 12 by 24s, or 18 by 18 by 24s, all of which work fabulously for this species. And I think it actually works better because the vivarium, because you see them more often when you have them in a 24 by 18 by 24, that's, you know, well planted, they're going to disappear into the woodwork. You know, they're just like, you know, okay, well, I've got an entire forest here. Well, you know, why do I need to come out anywhere? As opposed to, you know, in a slightly smaller vivarium or smaller vivarium in general, especially ones that have height. I'm going to start building my own, and I'm, you know, probably going to put them in a 15 by 15 by 24. That probably is kind of an ideal size, not because of the frog, interestingly enough, but because of the plants. So when you work with a small vivarium and you want to keep slow growing, vining plants in there that aren't going to consume the vivarium in, you know, 12 months, You want to have a little bit of vertical space and airflow, good airflow. And so and that's hard to do in a 12 by 12 by 18, but it can be done. And I'm successful at it. There's a video that I've got posted on my Instagram account that you can go to and you can see. It's a 12 by 12 by 18. I just posted it a couple of days ago. And, maybe a week ago or two, I don't know. But nonetheless, it's just a really nicely planted small bromeliad. So you need to stay with things like, Neuragelia, Zoe, what's the other one? Little Faith. That's the other one that I find works really well in that. And then, you just can't keep it overly humid because you just don't have the level of ventilation. Once you go to a 12 by 12 by 24, it changes everything. And the only thing at that point in time that becomes more difficult is, the froglets will be on the floor. And, they're really good producers, some of them. Red Vicentii produce really well. Typical clutch is 4 to 6. The green blue ones are, a lot harder. They just don't. I've got many different genetic lines, and they just don't produce at the same rate and don't mature at the same rate that the red ones do, in my experience.
Another question I have is, oftentimes, whether it's a new species or a locale or whatever comes into the hobby, and then a kind of a controversy ensues about where it came from, how it got into the hobby. What was it under questionable circumstances and whatnot? As far as I know, there's a little bit of controversy in that vein around this particular species. Do you have any thoughts on that at all?
Yeah, there's a lot of controversy first, we don't want to support the illegal importation of animals. And the reality is it illegal importation or illegal exportation, meaning that the origin country is not managing their exports, in the early days, so many things came through various different paths. Red-eyed tree frogs came from Nicaragua. I don't think they extend into Nicaragua, but they were, probably coming from Costa Rica and moving in there. We don't want to support that. And that's, I think universally accepted. But at the same time, the frogs that are here are here. And so we can argue till the cows come home about, the origin of the original pairs that were imported, whether it was to Europe, and in most cases that's the case, and there's various different arguments around that, whether it's the, a tink, species like yellowbacks or galactonotus, or whether it's the red Vicentii. There's all this brouhaha every time it comes up about, the origin story of that particular species, but they're here. And so, I've had conversations with others about this and, who felt strongly in a particular way. And I was like, well, what do you want us to do? Should we just, kill everything that came in, in some sort of an illegal, we'd kill everything, right? Because, almost everybody in the frog hobby has, we'll call it blood on their hands, right? Because, like so many of the species came in through strictly reptiles. And we know that if we, just by, there's been papers published on it that those species that came in through strictly, they came in under the auspices that they were captive bred in the country of origin, and we know mathematically that that's just not possible. And so we know that so many or most all of those were wild caught. And so anybody that's had a pomelo or had many different of the erotus, many of the tinks, you know, everybody kind of has, you know, some responsibility in that. And, you know, and it was a much bigger responsibility, really, at the end of the day, because when you think about what, you know, Strictly did as far as, you know, their illegal importations or their, you know, skirting the law, if you want to call it that, there's just, you know, everybody's responsible. And so, you know, and then you have the flip side of the story. So from my perspective, the animals here, we have a responsibility to keep the animal responsibly, to promote the propagation, and to prevent the need or the desire to, for anybody to ever desire to import them again, shall we, you know, so, and, you know, at the same time, you know, support organizations like Tesoros and Understory Enterprises and Mercury that basically do have, you know, very strong ethical supported type of operations in country of origin. And go from there. Vicente, I tend to get caught up in that controversy, and you know, by the time this story, you know, airs, there'll have been another, you know, huge brouhaha. And you know, again, you know, we don't want to support the illegal importation of animals, you know, we want to support, you know, quality ethical importation if necessary. But at the same time, you know, for the animals that are here, they're here. Let's propagate them responsibly and go from there. The other thing that I would say, and this is, you know, really leads into the Active Conservation Alliance, you know, a big part of, you know, this controversy is the construct of the native habitats. Or the animal being under threat in their native habitat. And I remember seeing recently a post from Sam Sakura, in Panama, of an area that, you know, basically was a wasteland. You know, it was this area that basically had been, you know, looked like it had been clear cut, now basically looked like a desert. But at once upon a time was you know, a locale of a specific Ufaga Vicentii. And so there's a responsibility in the country of origin as well. You know, there's all of this discussion around the fact that the animal is under threat in their country of origin. And, you know, but at the same time, what is the country of origin doing to protect that particular animal? And in a lot of cases, there's no criticism here, nothing, because the people that live there are, you know, trying to, you know, feed themselves and, you know, put up a farm or a cattle farm or, you know, raise a crop or whatever it happens to be. And that's why I'm so passionate about the Active Conservation Alliance, because it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. You don't have to clear cut a field in order to be able to feed your family. There may be other ways that you could, you know, take a portion of that and do it responsibly in such a way that you protect the adjacent forest and the person and the forest can live in harmony. And, you know, we see that all through Europe. You see, Europe is very aggressive about protecting their natural habitats, which abut, you know, neighborhoods and all sorts of other types of industry, and so the animals survive very effectively, and the people get to enjoy them, and so I think that's where. You know, that's why it's called the Active Conservation Alliance, right? So it's active conservation. Passive conservation is when you take a piece of land and you basically dedicate it forever and ever. Nobody gets to go here except under certain circumstances, and it's protected, and, you know, it can't be used by the natives. In contrast, you know, the idea of active conservation is the peoples and the habitats coexist, and we know that, you know, frogs are particularly sensitive to habitat destruction, and, you know, when you look at a faga, especially, know, you've got a genus of animal that, you know, will produce three, maybe four, maybe they produce five or six offspring in a rainy season. And if there's a couple of rainy seasons that are, you know, out, I guess you could say out by what I mean by out is that for whatever reason, the habitat is impacted in a negative way, whether that's through spillage or whatever, like phosphates, whatever it is that goes into the water that makes it harder for them to reproduce. You could, you know, basically eliminate an entire locale, not as a result of, you know, taking 10 or 20 or 30 animals out of that habitat for the hobby. And I don't promote that. I'm just saying, you know, logically, it doesn't make sense. You know, you're not going to take 20 Lamani out of the habitat and it's going to negatively impact the population, because if it did, they'd be extinct. But, you know, basically having the opportunity to actively conserve areas of land for the species that live there and doing that with the human population in kind.
Those are all really good points. And I agree with you. I think that you can't look at this from a single angle and expect to get an answer. I know that people like to engage in debates and discussions about the how, what, where, and why of how a certain species locale made it into the trade. And you're right. It's very, very easy to sit here in the US or in the UK or wherever behind a screen and make all these assertions that, you know, may help you sleep at night, but might not necessarily result in any kind of positive effects. And by that I mean is, like, I believe in moderation and I believe in management. I don't believe that you're going to magically make any kind of problem go away by just locking something up in a box and throwing away the key. You have to manage things. And with the dart frog locales that come in, like you said, they're here. So what are we supposed to do? Well, somebody's going to want them, regardless of whether they're here legally, illegally, questionably, whatever. Somebody's going to want them. And the question is, if somebody wants them, are they going to cause more poaching inside of a natural area to meet that demand? Or as a side effect of this particular locale, whatever, being here in the US, now people are captive breeding them and there's less of a demand. So it's a very Machiavellian argument. You know, do the ends justify the means? I understand and I respect all people's perspectives on it. I get it. But I mean, you make a very good point that it's not something you can just turn a blind eye to and just say, well, you know, hell with it. These things shouldn't be here. Let's just wipe them all out. Well, then someone's still going to want them. Even if we wiped everything out in the U.S., some person somewhere is going to go out of their way to get them. And then it's definitely going to end up being illegal. So it's you're right. It's a very complex issue. But I mean, just to kind of, you know, follow up on that point as well, you know, what I mentioned about people sitting behind a screen and saying things, and I get that and I respect that, but how many people are actually doing something about it? How many people are actually taking an active role in this type of conservation? And that is something that I see very, very often in the dart frog world. I see people like you making a concerted effort to actually get into the areas where these animals live, set up some sort of conservation initiative, and follow through with it. And I've seen that happen consistently in the dart frog hobby, and I don't see that in other hobbies. I don't see that as much. Occasionally I do see it, but I don't see that as much with reptiles. It's not just a common thing. I mean, within the dart frog hobby, it seems to be a pretty consistent narrative. And again, you've taken that initiative to actively work towards conservation. And even the name, as you just said, the ACA, Active Conservation Alliance. So, I mean, coming full circle in the hobby, you know, you and I came out at a time when the hobby was very much, I guess I could say take. Everything was coming in from the wild, very little, especially amphibians, were captive bred. And now we've kind of made this transition into everything being captive bred as the norm. And now we're going a step further and going back to the wild to try and preserve the sources of our founding stock. I kind of went on a little diatribe there. I apologize. I didn't mean to take over the reins. But, I mean, can you give us an update on how the ACA is faring and some of the strides that you've made since we spoke last back in December.
Yeah, well, we're really doing great and very fortunate in the sense that, you know, to your point, right? So, you know, basically protecting not just the source, but, you know, it doesn't just protect the source of the frog. It protects so many other species that live in that area. And then it doesn't necessarily have to be a frog that is of interest to the hobby. It could just be any of the frogs. And so I think that, you know, the construct is, you know, how do we not, you know, are you a good person or a bad person because, you know, because you keep this frog or you keep that frog? I think that, you know, how do you now translate that into a bigger meaning and give back, I guess you could say, for those, you know, habitats that are under threat, because that's the issue. The real issue, you know, the hobby is, you know, the pet hobby might deplete a population, but the hobby itself, there's way too many responsible breeders and keepers out there that it'll ever deplete a population. That said, you know, will the pet hobby, you know, probably in an instant. And so, you know, just like I was saying originally, you know, I walk in and I see, you know, cattle troughs full of various different lizards and turtles and other things that, you know, just it's almost gross. Well, in times it frankly was gross. So, you know, the ACA is doing great. We're really fortunate in the sense that we have a number of really significant contributors, and what I mean by that is that people like Jake Weiss and his family who've contributed, you know, five figures to the organization, and other major contributors that we've been able to garner through our personal relationships. And so that's really provided the seed money for the ACA. And we're, you know, the one area that I really wish we'd get a little bit more traction with is in those 10 and 20 and $25 contributions. So I'm making an appeal to everybody that's listening. We'd love to have you be a participant at some level with the Active Conservation Alliance, because we're making a difference and we're gaining traction. You'll see, if you want, you can go out to Active Conservation Alliance on Instagram, or our website, and we've hired a firm to help us with website development and our social media campaigns to really pump things up and get more activity out there. And we're going down different paths to try and appeal to a broader audience. But, you know, really, you know, we're focused on that dark frog environment. And we're now having the opportunity. We have two events coming up in Colombia where they're social events for the community associated with the specific one is in Adenobates and the other one is Silvatica, Ophaga Silvatica, where the community basically has a celebration around that habitat and around the frog specifically. And they bring the entire community in and the children, and there's education for the children, and there's other activities that the children participate in to learn about and to, you know, get closer to the construct of, you know, protecting their, you know, really prized native inhabitants. And so we have that going on. We're supporting La Reserva by Biopark in Bogota, and then, you know, we're actively working on some projects specifically around acquiring specific properties in Colombia to continue these efforts, not just for now, but for much longer. And so very exciting, very challenging work, I would have to say, because, you know, not everything comes up roses like you expect. But we're very grateful to our significant contributors that have, you know, gone out there and met Allison and Jake and a few others that we're grateful to you for having made a difference. Thanks.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you if you wanted to, you know, shout out any names, you know, because a lot of this type of effort, a lot of people really don't get the recognition that they deserve, because to do any type of conservation charity work is often, you don't get the notoriety that you would if you were, you know, movie star or whatever. But yeah, it's nice to hear the names of people who are involved. I give people a lot of credit for putting in work to this type of endeavor, because a lot of times, like you said, it can be tough. It can be rough work. What's the biggest challenge you've faced so far?
The biggest challenge is really growing the base of you know, people that are engaged and want to contribute. So, and when I say contribute, you know, it's great, you know, the fact that Jake and Allison Lockwood have been, you know, such generous contributors. We love that. We're very grateful for that. At the same time, you know, it would be great if we had, you know, more $5 contributors and you know, skip a cup of Joe, drop a drink at the bar, and throw $5 our way, or $10 or $25, whatever you got to spare. And, you know, the economy looks like it's doing a little bit better and people are employed. And so, you know, I'm hoping that doesn't scare people away. But nonetheless, the big challenge, of course, is always has been and always will be getting contributions. It is a tax deductible contribution, by the way. So, you know, it always helps at the end of the year or April 15th. I think the other challenge is, you know, basically working with, you know, the communities that we're working with and finding, you know, communities that want to actively participate and, you know, be supported in that process, not just from the frame of that they want to engage in, and I think everybody does, but, you know, there's been so many people that have come along and for the wrong reasons have promoted themselves into that environment and then, you know, taken things out that they shouldn't. And so with that in mind, people are, you know, appropriately skeptical. And that's, of course, why we're so glad and so appreciative of the people that are in Colombia that are supporting this effort.
Yeah, I remember in my conversation with you and Ivan and Julio back in December, you know, we talked about the importance of the human element as well, and how involving people within Colombia is just so important, because I feel like a lot of these conservation initiatives, you know, I mean, like here in the ESSEC, I've never been to Colombia. I'm never going to go to Colombia. So I feel like involving people who are local and who can really see the results of this firsthand, it's such an important thing. And I mean, here with me, if I'm going to get involved in some sort of conservation initiative, obviously it's going to be something that's right in front of me, like right in my back door, you know, right outside my back door. So I definitely see the value associated with incorporating people at a local level. Have you done any kind of, I'm trying to think, like if you were going to do a community outreach or anything like that, what are some stories from local people that you can share?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a number of different projects, and just one today, as a matter of fact, there is a celebration of their local fauna and flora, and the mayor of that particular community reached out and asked specifically if they could get support for this particular event, so that, you know, we could promote and support the ongoing you know, so that we could get support for the ongoing activities in that community around a specific, and I can't remember Adenabates sapata, if I'm not mistaken. I may be wrong. Only because I can't get access to the app that I have the information on, but nonetheless, just happened today. where they're asking us for support. And, the fact that they're asking us is, you know, really to me incredible, because that shows a level of engagement and activity that you wouldn't have otherwise. We're not having to go to them and say, hey, you know, let's drum this up, let's make this happen, as we have in some of the other locations where we're actively trying to engage the local communities to support their own ecology preservation efforts. But in this particular case, you know, they're actually, you know, recognizing that we exist, and they're making the ask. And, you know, to me, that just demonstrates a tremendous level of engagement beyond what we've seen at any point in time up until now. So the word's getting out, and the activities are happening to, you know, basically create the preservation of their local communities and their local ecology. And yeah, that in and of itself is super rewarding. And this is just our first, you know, really it's 6 months off the ground. And, you know, there was a lot of work to get to that point where we, you know, we're a registered 501c3. And that all happened last year. And so at the beginning of this year really was when we first got started. And so within 6 months, we have, you know, really started to make inroads and to have successes. Very exciting.
That's very encouraging. It's good to hear. I love when things start to work out. And really start to see, like, it's like planting a tree. You know what I mean? When you plant a tree and you take care of it, and eventually it finally bears fruit, and you get to see, like, the fruit of your labors. That's great, though. Where do you see yourself in 5 years, though? Like, what's the 5-year plan in terms of where you want to be and what you want to accomplish in, say, 2028 or by, we'll say, 2030? What are you looking to get done between now and then?
Well, you know, clearly we're still in that infancy stage, and our 5-year plan is not fully baked or developed. We do need to get together and have a couple of days where we can kind of knock out a more comprehensive 5-year plan and have, you know, are working towards that. We were hopeful that was going to happen here in July, but I took on a ton more responsibility at work, and Julio is really busy with his work as well. So we weren't able to do that then, but we're really excited about doing that here sometime in 2023. But very much, you know, bottom line is that we're really looking to, you know, solidify the base of contributors and grow that diversity in the contributors. So, you know, not just the Frogger world, but, you know, in other arenas that are people that are interested in supporting, you know, really important ecologic work as it relates to the areas that, you know, we're looking at. And then, you know, we're looking at things like carbon offsets. So as we acquire properties, you know, being able to utilize those for carbon offsets. So as you know, large companies have a, you know, stated goal is to, you know, every year we're going to basically be carbon neutral, or, you know, we're going to reduce this much carbon emission. Often they don't get there. And the way they compensate for that is by buying carbon, what's called carbon offsets. And so we're looking at carbon offsets as an opportunity for, you know, additional interest in what we're doing. And then, you know, that of course leads into the whole construct of being able to acquire properties, as well as to really support local communities in, you know, supporting their efforts to acquire and protect those areas that they live in. So I think, you know, that's the big vision, but we're still working through it.
Well, I'm going to encourage everyone to check out the ACA and donate. I mean, like you said, it's something, $5, you'd be surprised, goes a long way. It really does, whether it's gas to put in the car to go to town hall and get a permit. You know, simple things like that. It's small donations, you know, they count too. So again, I'm going to encourage everybody to check out the link in the show notes. And, you know, if you, again, like Michael said, it's tax deductible. So feel free to leave a little donation. It can definitely go a long way. You'd be surprised.
Yeah. And we'd be very grateful if you did.
Well, Michael, we're at the end, and I know we've discussed the ACA, but if you want to just maybe run down a couple of websites or resources if anybody wants to find out more, to donate or to learn more about the ACA, or even some of the frogs that you work with as well, how can the listeners find out more?
So, you know, the activeconservationalliance.org is the Active Conservation Alliance website. Please go out there, check it out. I'm hoping that we're going to have that up and re-smithed by the time this airs. So we're very, very close on all that. Yvonne's done tremendous work. We've worked with a group in Colombia that is helping us so as to reduce the cost exposure that we have on that. And so very excited about that. You know, basically go to Instagram and check out Active Conservation Alliance there and follow us. That would be another big, huge help. And then, you know, personally, I am, you can find me on Instagram at The Frog Dispensary or on Facebook at The Frog Dispensary. It's a triple entendre for anybody who's interested in knowing what that is. In any case, I'm a pharmacist and I live in Colorado. So dispensary has particular connotations there. And on top of that, you know, every once in a while, a frog leaves the house in a box and goes to somebody else and is dispensed that way. So in any case, yeah, look me up there, The Frog Dispensary. And again, really grateful for your support and for allowing me to come on and spend some time listening to a little bit about the history and the experience of a longtime herper.
Well, I appreciate it, Michael. I want to thank you for taking the time to come on and talk to us. All right, everyone. It's been a great episode. I love talking to people about the history of how the hobby started and hearing different people's perspectives. And Michael got started very, very early in the hobby. And I think it's always important to heed the advice and hear the experiences of people who started out back when we really didn't know too much. And then moving forward into the conservation initiative such as the ACA, shows a tremendous amount of value. And again, I encourage everybody to get involved. So again, I hope you guys enjoy this episode. I know I did. I love talking with people like Michael. It's always interesting. I hope you guys enjoyed it, and I'll catch up with you guys again next time.